This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new 31-foot-high sculpture by Frank Stella now stands in front of the East Wing of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. The first collection of his complete writings has just been published in conjunction with an exhibition of his work that's on tour in Europe, and there's a new gallery show of Stella's work in Manhattan. Although Frank Stella's recent work is oversized, wild, and colorful, he was one of the fathers of the minimalist art of the 60s. His early work in the late 50s was a series of black paintings whose austerity contrasted with the bold brushstrokes and drips of abstract expressionism. In the 60s, Stella moved on to geometrical paintings, often in vivid, clashing colors. I spoke with Frank Stella in November of 2000. Now, you're working on a very large scale now. You work not only in your studio, you have a foundry. You have a staff. You have a crew that you have to work with because the works are so large.
Yeah, people make a lot of that, actually. It's interesting that I have a... I mean, I it's not my foundry. I work at a foundry. I have a studio, and I have people who work with me and help me out. From my point of view, there's a lot of work to do, and we all work at it. I mean, it's not exactly collaboration because... by and large, they're supposed to be doing what I tell them to do. Sometimes they don't, and the results are good, and sometimes they don't, and the results are quite bad. But we've been doing it for a fairly long time. The people who work with me have worked for me for 15 or 20 years. But now it's sort of leveled out, and they're all, ready to go on to their own lives and everything like that. And it's sort of that kind of thing is winding down for me. But maybe that's why this is a sort of a last burst to get some big things done while I both have the energy and have people who can stay focused to work with me.
Now, I'm not an artist, but, I would think that that's something might get lost in the process of not just doing it all yourself, you know, the man alone in his room with his paint and the canvas or with his sculptural material.
It's sort of ludicrous, actually. I suppose that people can mess things up, but by and large, one man can't do very much. Although Michelangelo did fire some of his assistants when he was working on the Sistine Chapel because they were annoying him, I guess, and he had to finish it himself. On the other hand, I would be more than happy to have Sebastiano del Piombo and Perugino and Polidoro Caravaggio or something, the people that helped, Michelangelo. It wasn't bad, those kind of us.
But has your role as an artist become something you never imagined it would be? Somebody who basically has to run a business and pay a staff and work with a foundry?
It's changed. I mean, and it's just, but it's just as hard to pay for yourself or take care of your children or whatever you do. On the scale of it doesn't matter somehow all that much to me. I don't know. The one thing that hasn't changed actually is the problem is always the same, to get the work done. That's always hard. Money never made it easier, and now that I don't have so much money, it's still hard. I mean, I don't understand.
You don't understand what?
I don't understand how it came to be that you could be successful and so overwhelmingly unsuccessful at the same time, yeah.
What's the unsuccessful part?
It's the effort that it takes to make anything.
Right.
And it doesn't change the amount of effort that it's needed to make something good. In fact, actually, maybe it gets harder.
Your work has changed so much since the late 50s when the public became aware of your work. And you first became known for your black striped paintings. And these were paintings that helped launch the minimalist movement. Then you did color paintings that often used very geometrical forms. And then eventually your work became like wildly colored with drips and brushstrokes, and your work became more sculptural with a lot of like edges, and you started working with hard materials like metal. Do you feel that by starting with all black and then by adding color and then adding more kind of wild elements to it, that you strip things down to a basic vocabulary of yours and then kind of added things to that vocabulary and built things up again?
I suppose. I mean, you can imagine it, I guess, a life story any way you want. I mean, it starts with a lot of youthful enthusiasm and ends with mature wisdom, which is a simplification of everything that happens. Or you can start out as a sort of aggressive, hard-nosed, kind of arrogant youth and pare everything down and dare everybody to say that you can't, that you can't get it all before you even know what it's all about.
Did you feel like your early black canvases were a dare?
I think they were. I mean, they were pretty aggressive, yeah. But I felt very confident about them, yeah.
What were they about to you? What did you see yourself as trying to do or to say?
Well, it was about being able to make an abstract painting that really wasn't based on anything but the gesture of making itself. So that the gesture of drawing is just it was just the path of the stripe that was the created the painting, or sort of the path of the brush on the canvas.
Why? Go ahead.
Well, it's not most drawing is outline or edging to create a form, and the drawing and the painting in this work was one, and it didn't create a form; it was the form.
What did you think were some of the most interesting on-track and off-track pieces of art criticism about your early work?
Well, I had a hard time with criticism because, I really liked what I did and I was interested in painting and I had a kind of critical attitude towards painting. But the writing about it was really a little bit beyond me. I mean, I was a relatively unsophisticated person in that way. I mean, I really wasn't interested in philosophy or in the notion that you could appeal to smart people by saying smart things about painting. I just wanted to make paintings that I liked. I didn't care if smart people liked them, actually, unfortunately. But it's hard to make paintings, and I was really interested in the idea of art. And criticism is a little tricky because criticism is worried about so many things, and it hardly ever worries about how good the art is or how hard it is to make art. So I'm not criticizing criticism, but it always has to place it within a context. And if you're actually the person who's making the art, there is no context. The context is the immediate moment that you make the painting and the paintings you make. And that's the only place I live in, or I am. I am there, and that's where I live. And then the other things happen afterwards. But, you know, to me, criticism is like, a sport or entertainment or something. It's not, unfortunately, really serious for me.
What was the impact on you to become famous and controversial when you're in your 20s and just starting off as a painter?
Actually, the thing about being famous and never, I wasn't worried about it because the art world was a much smaller place, and I had not much interest in fame. I liked other artists who were famous, and but I really wanted more than anything to make art that was as good as the good artists were making. I wanted to make art that someday, and I didn't expect it to be that way right away, it would be as good as de Kooning or Klein or Newman or Pollock or Rothko. They were my heroes, and I wanted to make art that was as good as that. All I cared about was whether if you put one of my paintings next to a Rothko, it looked okay. That's what I wanted. I don't know what fame is really, but I mean, that was what I was interested in.
When you were in your 20s, in the 1950s, it was a period when some of the very famous artists like Pollock were famous not only for their work, but for their lifestyle. You know, a kind of bohemian lifestyle
and big deal
a lot of drinking and everything.
Right.
And some people in their attempt to be artists would emulate the lifestyle as well. Did that lifestyle mean anything to you? Is it?
No, it didn't mean much, largely because I was so young, and it was just very hard to, keep yourself together. I mean, to keep working, to get money, to do whatever you have to do. I mean, I didn't really actually have that much time to get drunk.
Artist Frank Stella is my guest. You grew up in, I think, a pretty middle-class family.
Yes.
Father was
yes.
a doctor, a gynecologist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And apparently he worked as a house painter during the Depression to put himself through college.
Yes.
And from what I've read, it sounds like occasionally he'd, like, repaint the house you lived in and you'd help him paint.
I was in paint all my life, yes. Yeah.
Did you enjoy the feel of house paint or the colors of house paint?
Yes, I did. I liked it. I mean, I always liked paint, the physicality of it, yeah. It was never a problem for me. My mother was an artist, too, and she painted with oil, and my father painted with house paint, so I had paint pretty well covered. When I first saw de Kooning and Klein, say, for example, and even Pollock, I knew right away how it was done. I mean, it wasn't a problem for me about how to make those kind of paintings.
And did you know that more from house paint than anything else?
Yes, yeah. I knew it from painting houses. And, I mean, even at the time that Pollock was doing it, I mean, there's a tradition for decorating and dripping paint on floors and on furniture and stuff. So, I mean, it's been around. I mean, it just hadn't been in the art world.
So what connection did you see between, you know, the house painting and the Pollocks?
Well, I thought, painting a wall is a big physical expanse. You do it, and I could see most of the time that if you stopped halfway through where you were painting your wall, it would be a lot more interesting. But, you know, no one's going to let you stop and sort of have it half white and half red. But it was beautiful, and so I liked doing it. And I could easily see that you could make paintings like that.
How did you get from, you know, painting walls to actually painting canvases?
Well, I mean, I painted all my way through school. I mean, I went to Phillips Academy in Andover, and I took art classes. And then when I was at Princeton, we had art teachers, and I took classes there. And I just, you know, I was around the studios, as it were.
Yet the impression I get from reading interviews with you is that you never studied the technique of representational art.
That's true. When I was at Phillips Academy, you had to. There was an introductory course which consisted to the arts, to fine art, and that consisted of an art history course and a studio course. It was a combination, so you went to art history lectures, and then you went to the studio and you made paintings. And one of the prerequisites in the painting course, the first thing was a kind of motif. So you had to make a painting. Of a still life, you know, there was something set up, and that was a requirement. But then you went on from there, and somehow I don't know how it worked. Actually, Patrick Morgan, who was a painter, and his wife Maud Morgan was a painter, and she showed in New York, and he showed in Boston. They were relatively at that time successful painters in the early 50s. That was Pat's idea of the course. You did that, and then you went on to do something else or whatever it was. But they made it. You know, you had to. You couldn't make a mess. You had to sort of paint it in some kind of way. And so I didn't really like it and everything. And we had a class, and they started showing us about Seurat and neo-impressionism and things like that. And then I said to myself, oh, that's kind of obvious. So I ran downstairs to do my painting, and I just made it all splotches. So I made a table with splotches, a cylinder with splotches, some ivy with splotches, and it all held together. It looked sort of like a painting. And everyone else was doing the modeling and the light and shadow and having a wonderful time doing what they were doing, but I was done. And I showed it to Pat Morgan, and he said, all right. And he let me go, and from there on, I just did whatever I wanted. I didn't have to do any more representational art.
So how much did you actually do before abandoning it?
Well, I did about 20 minutes.
how old were you?
I was probably 15.
And I'm surprised that your teacher just kind of allowed you to dismiss the technique like that.
Look, I was a wise guy, but, you know, a lot of teachers have to deal with kids who are wise guys. I mean, but if you know what you're doing, I mean, it's like, you know, what are you going to do? You're the tennis coach, and the kid comes in and he hits the ball 90, 80, 90 miles an hour, and no matter what you do, he hits it back. You know, you can say, well, that's not exactly the right way to do it, and you can talk to him, but you're not going to tell him to forget it. I mean, you know, either you can hit the ball or you can't.
My guest is artist Frank Stella. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with artist Frank Stella. No, what was it that made you realize that you just weren't about representational art? Was it a technical problem or just like an aesthetic lack of interest?
I had representational art on my window. My mother painted Santa Claus on there, and she was always making paintings. I saw representational art all the time. I wasn't very moved by it, but when I saw magazine reproductions of Franz Klein, and when I saw the Pollock painting and the paintings and the Hans Hofmann paintings in Patrick Morgan's house and in the gallery at the Addison Gallery, I mean, I was overwhelmed by that. I mean, I just loved them, and I wanted to make paintings like that, and I just wasn't going to let anything keep me from making paintings like that right away. I wasn't going to wait 10 years and then make an abstract painting.
Was there ever a point in your life where you said to yourself, I wish that I had studied representational technique and that I had more of that technique available to me?
I didn't understand representational painting very much, and I probably wouldn't understand representational technique up to a point. But when I, maybe 30 years later, when I saw in the Capitoline Museum Caravaggio's St. John the Baptist, the young St. John the Baptist, it really knocked me out, and I really liked it, and it was very real. And the realist technique, I should have said, oh my God, but I can't do this, and I should have been very worried about it. But it actually, the effect was the opposite. It was a kind of incredible euphoria about saying, you know, actually, that's it. You know, that's what painting is about. And I realized that Caravaggio's success and what made this painting beautiful, which was its sense of being very real, being very physically present, had to do with the fact, had actually nothing to do with the technique, but with the fact that Caravaggio worked very hard at painting and that he had wanted to make a painting. And once I realized that, you know, the goal is what counts, what you intend to do, what you want to make, making things pictorial is what's important. The technique you use to make the pictoriality manifest, to make it successful, that doesn't really matter. You know, you get the job done whichever way you can. They never had a problem in the caves in Lascaux or wherever, Altamira. They got the job done.
I want to, if it's okay with you, ask you about your finger.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, yeah.
You have one finger that...
Yeah, I have a crushed left hand. Yeah, yeah. I have one finger is half, and a couple of the other fingers are damaged. Yeah, it's a crush injury from when I was 10 years old.
What happened?
A concrete urn in the yard was toppled over onto my hand. That's all. It was a crush injury.
And were the parts of your finger amputated on the spot, or was that
Well, when it's crushed, it turns black. I mean, eventually they had to cut it off. Yeah, I went to the hospital, yeah.
And you do a lot of physical work. It's never interfered with it?
Yeah, but I'm right-handed, so it's not...
And it's your left hand that was crushed?
Yeah.
So you're okay with that?
It's not a problem.
And I think, did that get you out of the military?
Actually, indirectly it did, yeah. And I wasn't thinking about it, but... and it was a turning point in my artistic career because when I left school... when I graduated from Princeton, I went to New York and took a loft and started painting. And I wasn't really that aggressive about being a painter or being an artist, but I did it because I had to go in that September to go home to Boston to take a physical examination. We still had for the draft. And I expected to be drafted. So I thought, well, you know, this is just dead time. I'll paint for a while and then go in the Army. And then I'll worry about my career when I get out, after I do my military service. And that really was the only thought that I had. I mean, it wasn't complicated and it wasn't conflicted or anything. I mean, I was just painting and living in New York with my friends, meeting people and making paintings. And then I went to take my physical examination. And I didn't really want to go in the Army, so I did all the things. I wet my bed, I sucked my thumb. They just laughed at me. They stamped all my... papers, and then the last guy, there were three doctors in a row on the table, and the guy looked at me and he said, let me see your left hand. And I said, yes, sir. And he picked up an envelope and he held out the envelope to me. He said, put this between your thumb and your index finger. And I said, yes, sir. Your third finger, your fourth finger, your little finger. And I said, yes, sir. He said, you know, son, you have faulty opposition. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, you don't want to go in the Army, do you? And I said, no, sir. Which I think is not exactly what I should have said. And he said, you know, he said, you went to Princeton, didn't you? And I said, yes, sir. He said, I don't think you'd make a very good soldier anyway. And he picked up the other thing and he stamped it and I was out.
How'd you feel?
Well, I felt weird, actually. I mean, I was happy not to be in the Army. And then I suddenly realized that I was going to go back to New York to my studio. That I didn't have a career ahead of me in the Army. They kept telling me my tour of duty would be in West Germany or Korea. And I wasn't sure which fabulous place I wanted to go to, but I had these fantasies of going on tour. I mean, the Army tour is a little bit different than my idea of touring. But anyway, I called up my father and I said, gee, I'm sorry, Dad, I have bad news. I failed my physical examination. I won't be able to go in the Army. And he said, too bad, it would have made a man of you. And I said, well, I'm just going to go back to my studio. And that was it.
Were there things you had to face in the studio that you didn't feel ready to face yet because you thought you were... putting all of that off till after your tour of duty?
You know, no, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't a problem. I don't know why. I just went back to my studio and kept on painting. Life at that age, New York was sort of relatively gentle there. I mean, there were artists around and you could sort of bum around and it was okay. You could manage.
Well, Frank Stella, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Artist Frank Stella recorded in November 2000. His new 31-foot-high sculpture now stands in front of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. His recent work is on exhibit in Manhattan at the Paul Kasman Gallery. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.